From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Lynn Neary. Cities that fall on hard times often face the same staggering problem, abandoned properties. In Detroit, an estimated 40 square miles of land sit vacant. Added up, that's an area larger than Miami. Well, some Detroiters are using that emptiness to quietly reshape their neighborhoods. They're annexing vacant lots around them, buying them, or just fencing them off. That story now from Kate Davidson of the Midwest reporting project, Changing Gears.
Call them blotters. B-L-O-T, blot. That's not a negative term. Blots are properties between the size of a lot and a city block. The easiest way to find blots in Detroit is to just look for a very long fence.
We're walking on the side of my house. My lot extends corner to corner.
Kevin Garcia's immediate neighbor is emptiness. So far, he's annexed four of the vacant lots surrounding him, and he did it legally. He bought them.
This lot here, I had an issue with the city of Detroit trying to obtain it. It took me 10 years of hard work and perseverance to get this from them.
Cities often hold on to land if they think there's potential for redevelopment. But in this neighborhood,
pretty much I've seen every structure on my block burn, unfortunately. It's got as bad as where I've seen two burn at the same time.
Garcia throws shotgun shells on his front porch to keep intruders away. He buried his dog in back after someone shot it. Still, Garcia says this neighborhood is a gem. There's space now, lots of it. Behind the fence, he's planted trees and shrubs, honey locust, Siberian elm, white pine, purple lilac.
If I want to go to the park, I just go out here in the backyard. I can pretty much enjoy everything that I can there without the travel time.
Now keep in mind that Detroit was built to be packed tightly with working-class homes, but the city has lost a million people since the 1950s. That's more than half its population. That left gaping holes in the structure of neighborhoods. Blotters aren't waiting for the city to fix that.
I call it an everyday remaking.
Margaret Dewar is an urban planning professor at the University of Michigan.
Every day there's a little step in this direction of remaking by people who are pretty invisible, but over time it becomes a dominant feature of the city.
Dewar sampled tax foreclosed properties resold by the city over 20 years. She found more than a quarter were bought by the homeowner right next door. But not every blotter is so lucky. Behind this fence is the house Paul Brown's family bought in 1925. Next to it stretch four lots, an oasis of fruit trees and gardens, but there's a catch.
This one's actually a city lot.
So you don't own this lot?
No, I'd like to, but they want to sell it. More than willing to buy it off of them.
It turns out the only lot the family actually owns is the one that's farthest from the house. They tried but failed to buy the middle lots years ago. So why put all this effort into land they don't own?
Because we live next door to it. If you go up the next block from here, you'll see what it would look like. Just overgrown brush piles, trash, car parts. And it's only from stubbornness and perseverance that keeps it from becoming a debris pile.
In Detroit, Cleveland, New Orleans, and many other cities, residents already get first dibs on adjacent empty lots. The idea is to stabilize neighborhoods and bring land back on the tax rolls. So, for instance, some Cleveland homeowners can buy an empty side lot for as little as a dollar. In Detroit, it's $200. The city has sold about 1,000 lots in the past 5 years, but it owns 60,000 parcels of land, most of it vacant.
We haven't really promoted the program. I think that's why we have such small numbers.
Rob Anderson is Detroit's new planning director, and his staff just started studying the adjacent lot program and how to expedite it.
What I don't want to have happen is we promote it and we're not ready for, you know, an influx of interest. I want to make sure that people don't get bogged down once they approach us.
But people here already get bogged down in bureaucracy. It can take years for residents to buy the lot next door. Anderson says his new goal will be 30 days. For NPR News, I'm Kate Davidson in Detroit.
Call them Jen Wrong Place, Wrong Time. This generation of young people faces extraordinary economic challenges with unemployment and college costs both sky high. Here's an example, the small town of East Millinocket, Maine. For more than a century, the paper mill there provided good-paying middle-class jobs. Now, as the paper industry has declined, young people are scrambling to find a new path. As part of our series, Hard Times, A Journey Across America, NPR's Tovia Smith has this report.
Try to ask young folks in East Millinocket how they feel about their economic future here, and you pretty much have your answer before you even start.
There aren't a lot of 22-year-olds in the area. They're gone. Okay.
School Superintendent Quentin Clark has seen it both personally and professionally. As young adults left town for college and jobs, classes that used to be 100 or 200 kids have shrunk down to 20 or 30. Clark's own kids left to start their careers in Beijing and Africa, a completely foreign idea when Clark was a kid.
It used to be that opportunity was a quarter of a mile away, the bottom of the hill.
The paper mill in East Millinocket used to be where kids would literally run the day they graduated high school. Generations grew up guaranteed a good job at a good wage for life. 4,000 once worked here. None could have imagined the reality today, just 200 or so workers and four times as many applicants turned away.
It's still scary because to be tough.
As an honor student and captain of the soccer team, Jared Lyons is the kind of high school senior who should be feeling downright cocky about his future. But having watched his father lose his mill job and the economy crumble, he worries now about how he'll afford college and achieve his dream to become a doctor.
I mean, it really can't get worse than it is now in this recession we're in. So
The whole economy in whole is just, it sucks, for lack of a better term.
That's Matt Morris, a junior who's also looking to make a career in the medical field.
We're going to have to work very hard, but a lot of it's not even in our hands either.
That can be the hardest part for kids who've always been told if they just study hard and get good grades, they can do whatever they want. Instead, students like these, who've done everything right, have a hard time finding even an after-school job for minimum wage. In the heart of East Millinocket, the pharmacy is empty at noontime, and there's little else around besides two bars and a gas station. Not much opportunity for a kid looking for work, like 17-year-old Crystal Rodriguez. She didn't want to talk about it herself, but her dad, Dwayne Rodriguez, says Crystal's job search has been almost unbearable.
Seems really depressed about it, you know, she's really down. I think she feels like no hope, and she just stays in her room all day, and then sometimes she'll have more hope again, and she'll go, I'm going to go out today, and I'm going to go look again.
But with unemployment around 17% around here, competition is fierce, even in surrounding towns, as 17-year-old Taylor Federico found out.
I tried, you know, McDonald's and grocery stores and stuff.
Did you get a call back?
No, not yet. But they already have people working there, like old people.
You know, a lot of these kids are competing now in the workplace, you know, with people who have 25 years experience who are not too good to be working for $7.50 an hour behind the fryer later. And so that adds a whole other layer to their challenges.
That's Nancy McKechnie, youth manager for the Eastern Maine Development Corporation, a nonprofit that offers job training, career counseling, and classes in everything from computers to anatomy.
Look at me. What's my belly button compared to my chin? Inferior. It's on the trunk.
Instructor Larry Lankhurst goes through a drill on medical terminology to a class filled with as many 40 and 50-year-olds as 20-somethings.
Okay. What is my elbow compared to my wrist? Do you use superior and inferior? No. Because on the appendages, you're going to use proximal distal.
Medical classes draw some of the most ambitious, like 18-year-old Elizabeth Haven, who's hoping to become a nurse.
Odds are stacked against us. Younger kids, but you'll always need nurses and doctors, and you'll be set for life if you go in the medical field, and I should be fine.
Administrators describe Haven as one of the most driven kids they've ever met. She undoubtedly will be fine, they say. It's the less motivated kids they worry about. Gone are the good old days when everyone could count on a mill job, valedictorian or not. But high school principal John Farrington says some in town have yet to adapt.
I wonder all the time what is going to become of these young men and young women if they don't get their act together in a hurry. And how do we light a fire under these kids? It's a tough thing to do.
All right, so part of the assessment that we did, you did very well with the reading, and the math was a little bit on the low side. So we need to get you focused on
math.
That
was bad, man.
Taylor Federico huddles with career advisor Joyce Santerre, who's helping her get her GED, and then, she hopes, some kind of job in healthcare.
The career exploration software, that's going to help to establish what you would like to do in the medical field. I did hear
the help is especially important to children of mill workers who never experienced the whole what do I want to do when I grow up thing, like Taylor's mother, Toni Federico.
Yeah, you need somebody to guide you, you know? I mean, I wasn't the only parent looking for, you know, where to start. And it was like, oh, thank God I found somebody that can send me in the right direction, you know, and get my child on the right path. So,
Judy, ready to go to form now?
Yeah.
Okay, you want to stop and get gas so that you...
I'll get
on
the way back.
Okay.
At home after school, Kim Lyon's son, Jared, has got that part figured out. He knows his path to become a doctor will be much longer than his father's short walk down to the mill, but it's worth it, Jared says, if that's what it takes to make sure he doesn't find himself 20 years from now out of work like his father and so many others.
I wouldn't trade it. I'd rather be in this situation, be more prepared. You'd be tougher to get through it.
Yeah, I mean, that's your dream. You want him to go farther than we did.
Better.
Like, you know, shoot for the moon, but hope you land among the stars. At least you've gone somewhere.
The sad part is that somewhere will most likely not be East Millinocket, Maine. For Jared, achieving that American dream of prosperity and doing better than his parents will almost surely mean leaving the place where his entire family has lived and prospered for generations. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
You can follow our month-long series on Twitter at NPR Hard Times and at our website, npr.org. Now a look at the challenges of launching a new company. The founders of Blue Box Now, a web-based marketing firm, felt they were on track at the beginning. The Seattle startup had lined up a large paying customer, it had lots of other great leads, and it was reasonably confident it would have a sizable amount of outside funding. But a lot has happened since those first days. Morning Edition has been following the startup, and NPR's Wendy Kaufman brings us this update.
The past couple of months have been pretty gut-wrenching for the team at Blue Box Now. One of the original founders had to leave Seattle because of a family medical emergency, and he took a full-time job somewhere else. Then, says Chad Reed, one of the remaining co-founders, there was a legal challenge.
That was a doozy. I'll tell you what. We received this letter in the mail and then also over email. There's another group in Seattle called the Blue Box Group.
That group wanted the startup to quit using the Blue Box name. Reed says while they thought they would prevail on the legal issue, they couldn't afford to fight.
Instead of us paying $40,000 to fight this, we're going to end up changing our name. And the Blue Box itself, the gift that we give, is still a key component to what we do. It's just changing up the name, and we're going to be okay with it.
The startup's goal is to help its clients increase customer loyalty and spending through the use of online games and prizes. But so far, just one company has signed up. That marketing campaign is months behind schedule, so there's no money coming in. Moreover, without proof their marketing concept works, it's difficult for the team to attract investors. Getting investors, be they angels or venture capitalists, was the main goal for Demo Day, held last month in Seattle.
My name is Chad Reed. This is my co-founder, Naresh Damon. Today, we're going to show you how we're changing the way loyalty marketing is done. Our platform is available on web, smartphones, and on tablets.
Blue Box, or whatever it's going to be called, was a participant in a highly selective incubator and boot camp for technology startups. Their presentation at Techstars Demo Day was attended by hundreds of people. Many of them were investors. And afterward, CEO Naresh Damon was sounding pretty optimistic.
Actually, one of the investors was saying, okay, do you have term sheet? So that is very motivating. But I think what benefits most is the right investor also.
But right now, Blue Box would likely be happy with almost any investor.
I'm Brad Gillespie from IA Ventures, a early stage venture firm based in New York City. As an investor, I'm really focused on five things. In order of priority, it's people, 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 market, and product.
Gillespie had been talking to the Blue Box team and was impressed, but in the end didn't invest. And another potential investor, Dave Carlson, is still on the sidelines. Carlson said he likes what Blue Box is doing, but he wants to see more numbers.
I'm a very financially oriented investor. I say my head and my heart have to be aligned, and the numbers have to make sense.
Faced with the reality that they don't have nearly as much money as they'd expected to raise by now, the founders of Blue Box are rethinking their options. Chad Reed says lots of well-known companies remain interested in talking to them, and he believes that if a sizable number sign up for their marketing campaigns, the startup will be able to raise a chunk of money. But in the meantime, Reed, who's been working without a salary since spring, doesn't get paid.
If we don't get funding, I mean, I can't live, right? I mean, you have to make money. I believe so much in this company that, yes, I'm going to continue building it and moving forward, but I'm going to have to take some sort of consulting job, which means that you're not spending the time that you should be on the product.
Which means, of course, it could take longer to get those customers. As for Naresh Damon, his wife is talking about getting a job, allowing him to continue to focus on Blue Box. And he, like Chad Reed, remains optimistic. After all, no one ever said that launching a startup would be easy. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
With all the stories of economic woe across the Atlantic, we've decided to look at what Europe's debt crisis means for this country. So we've invited in NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giewax. Welcome, Marilyn.
Hi, it's good to be back.
So a few days ago, our own Federal Reserve Bank stepped into this crisis, right? The Fed joined other central banks to make it easier for banks around the world to get their hands on dollars. So why would we do that? Because at first it seemed like the U.S. really wouldn't get too involved in this.
Well, it can seem like Europe's troubles sound so far away, and especially at a time when our own job market is still weak, home prices are still falling, you'd think we have plenty of things to worry about right here at home. But really, we are so tied to the European economy that the United States cannot afford to ignore this European debt problem.
But how does it actually affect us?
Well, there's several ways. I'll start with just the simplest one. The European Union has 27 countries, and together, they're our single biggest trading partner. We do about $500 billion worth of trade with Europeans. And, you know, they're very good customers. That means U.S. corporations get a lot of profits from Europe. Those profits help prop up our stock market. So Americans have a lot of interest in seeing Europe continuing to grow. Believe me, whether you are a coal miner in West Virginia or a corn grower in Iowa or maybe a chemical plant worker in Texas, you do not want to see your European customers cutting back on their spending. We need Europe to stay healthy to maximize our own exports and our profits.
Okay, so that's the issue of trade. I mean, are there any other connections that we can better understand this?
Well, we don't only trade with Europe, we also compete with Europe. We want to sell our goods to customers in Asia and the rest of the world. So if Europe's troubles are driving down the value of their euro, they have an advantage over us. German exports have been booming for a couple of years now, in large part because this falling euro has given them a competitive advantage.
So it makes their goods cheaper?
Exactly. Think of it this way. Say you're a customer in China and you're trying to decide between a German car and an American car. If their currency is cheaper for you, well, the German car is going to be the better bargain, even if it really isn't the better vehicle. So that's a pretty unfair competitive advantage. But everything we've talked about has really just amounted to small potatoes compared with the really big issue, and that has to do with the banks.
So what is happening with the banks? And by banks, you mean the Europe's banks or what's happening here in the U.S.?
Well, it's both, because whether we like it or not, big financial institutions are global today. You know, if you looked inside your own wallet, you might find an HSBC credit card. That company's based in London. Maybe you've got your savings with ING. That's a Dutch company. The reality is that our financial systems are really woven together. And unfortunately, the banks in Europe own a lot of the debt that was issued by those European governments. So if Greece or Spain or Italy or any of those countries suddenly defaulted on their debts, those European banks would find themselves becoming insolvent. They'd be holding a lot of worthless assets. And That would be horrible for us. You remember in 2008 how bad the financial markets were when they were melting down?
I was going to say, I've got a feeling of deja vu here.
Yeah, remember, we all remember that feeling pretty well. 3 years ago, it was U.S. housing debt that triggered this. It could be that European government debt could trigger the same kind of contagion. But the big thing is coming up this week. In Brussels, the European leaders are going to get together. They're going to try to come up with a comprehensive plan. And some economists are actually fairly optimistic at this point. They think everyone understands how high the stakes are. But don't break out that French champagne just yet, because they've got a lot of work to do to really address the core problem of dealing with all of that government debt.
NPR senior business editor Marilyn Gwax, thanks so much.
You're welcome.